All right, thanks. My name's Cornell. This is work with Chin, who's sitting up there. She's happy to take all of your questions afterwards. So before we begin, I just want to sort of lay down the definitions that I'm going to be using. This is my first time at this meeting, so I may be saying things very wrong, and I apologize for that in advance. I conceive of all features that you could compute from speech in these four areas, where on the left-hand side, I consider coarse spectral features, and on the right-hand side, fine spectral features. And at the top two panels, things that characterize a single frame of speech, whereas at the bottom, things that characterize a trajectory that models things across frames. So all the features that you probably are familiar with can be used to tessellate this space. And prosodic features tend to be those that either model the fine structure in the spectrum or those that model long-term dependencies at the bottom. But we here, in this paper, are going to look at only the so-called instantaneous prosodic features, namely those that characterize a single frame. And in particular, I'll be looking at pitch. Okay, so pitch is estimated using a pitch detector, which typically produces a best estimate for pitch, but it usually is so noisy that a pitch detector is typically expected to produce n-best estimates, and then a dynamic programming approach is used to consolidate that to a single best estimate per frame. I'm going to refer to these two components as pitch estimation, and the best estimate per frame that comes out of this can be linearly or non-linearly smoothed, can be normalized based on proximity to some kind of landmark, and then different kinds of features can be extracted from an assumed model. Now, these things at the bottom here, I assume, are what you are calling high-level feature computation or high-level features. In this talk, I hope I'm not disappointing anyone, we're actually going to be looking at this part, which is as low-level as you can be in a session on high-level features. We're going to claim that these features are as low-level as MFCCs. Okay, so if we look at this red box a little bit more closely, typically pitch estimation or pitch detection is a two-step process where the source domain, the thing we start from, is an FFT. So the first step is the computation of what I'm going to be calling a transform domain. And there's lots of alternatives here. The one that's most famous is the autocorrelation spectrum. And then the second step is simply finding the argmax. So a lot of effort has gone into this process, and typically the effort is focused only on this first step because this second step is so elementary that nobody really questions it. Most of the work on improving pitch detection has gone into making sure that these transform domains are such that their maxima correspond optimally or most frequently to what we consider to be pitch. What we're going to claim in this work is that you should just throw out this whole second step and you should model the entire transform domain signal. Okay, and that's what this talk is about. So there are four parts to this talk. I'm going to describe what I'm calling the harmonic structure transform. I'll be presenting some experiments, some additional analysis, and then I will conclude with three slides at the end. Excuse me for a second. Okay, so the particular pitch detection algorithm that we're going to look at is was proposed by Schroeder in 1968, and it involves summing, producing a new spectrum, the sigma spectrum, where at each frequency we have the sum of all the frequencies that are integer multiples of some candidate fundamental frequency in the original FFT. Okay, and this was very quickly after he proposed this dubbed harmonic compression, which is distinctly a nonlinear operation. I want to demonstrate it over here on the right. Basically, what ends up happening is the spectrum is compressed conceptually by integer factors, and then it's summed vertically, right? And the problem with calling this harmonic compression is that it has led to people actually looking for implementations of this algorithm in exactly this way. So first compress and then add. And it turns out that this has occupied people for about 20 years in the last century. A much better way to do this is to actually not do any compression, but to use a comb filter. So you just add whatever's at whatever frequency you want without first having to compress it towards the candidate harmonic frequency or fundamental frequency that you're interested in. So when this happens, there are, of course, no compression difficulties. Filtering is linear. We, in this work, are going to be defining all of our filters over this range of 300 hertz to 8,000 hertz. If you have lots of such comb filters, then that yields a filter bank. And in this work, we're going to nominally treat 400 filters in this filter bank, which range from 50 to 450 hertz spaced 1 hertz apart. So this is in the continuous frequency space. Of course, we want a discrete frequency space filter because we have discrete FFTs. So there are lots of ways to do this, and I always like citing here the work by Yenar and colleagues from LIMSI because this is actually work that influenced me, but it's probably not the first work. What we're going to do in this work is a little bit different. We're going to assume that each tooth of the comb is triangular, and then we're going to simply Riemann sample this such that the filter for that comb filter, the discrete filter, actually ends up looking like this. And as you will note, it doesn't look harmonic at all. Okay, so what do you do with this now? So if you have a set of such discrete comb filters, then that actually implements a filter bank that has a matrix representation H, and it's very simple to use. It's matrix multiplication by the FFT that you have, and we're also going to take the logarithm of the output of that filter bank the same way that's done for the Mel frequency filters. Finally, we're going to subtract from that the energy that's found at specific integer multiples of a specific candidate fundamental frequency. We're going to subtract from that the energy found everywhere else. Right? And to do that, we're going to form this complement transform H tilde, which I can demonstrate over here. This is the column vector for a particular comb filter. Then we just form the unity complement, right? And that gives us this here. So that's the corresponding column vector of H tilde. What this, of course, implements a very naive form of the harmonic to noise ratio, which is known to correlate with hoarse voice or hoarseness or roughness or breathiness. And typically in pathological use of this tool, what's done is the harmonic to noise ratio is computed only at the fundamental frequency once that is known. And what we're doing is we're computing it for all possible candidate fundamental frequencies and then using that vector as a feature representation. Okay, so the elements of this are still correlated, and we decorrelate them in the way that anybody else would. We subtract a global mean, we form a decorrelation matrix, and then we truncate, after applying that matrix, all those features that are in dimensions that have non-positive eigenvalues. We're going to call the output of this the harmonic structure Kestrel coefficients, for lack of a better term. And this is simply a decorrelation of the logarithm of the output of the filter banks minus some normalization term, which is our H tilde here. We actually explore two different options for this, both PCA and LDA, which you probably know more about than I do. So I've claimed that this is at the level of the MFCCs, but I would like to try to convince you here that it's nearly identical from a functional point of view. The ML filter bank can, of course, also be implemented as a matrix. And so if that's M, you can see that at least inside here, it's approximately the same. It's a matrix multiplication and a logarithm. The decorrelating transform is, of course, different. And it's sort of important and, in our case, unfortunate that our decorrelating matrix is data dependent, whereas the MFCC one is not. But to compare here M and H, these are essentially the columns of M. That is to say, they smear energy across frequencies that are related by adjacency, whereas the columns of H, the matrix that we're proposing here, smear energy across frequencies that are related by harmonicity. I also want to just say that this is a direct sort of follow-on from our previous work using a representation called fundamental frequency variation, which models the instantaneous change in fundamental frequency without actually computing the fundamental frequency. So what we're doing here in the current work is we take a frame of speech, we take its FFT, and then we take a bunch of idealized FFTs that are the comb filters or the columns of our capital H. We form the dot matrix of the frame that we are currently looking at with every one of these. And the locus of these dot products, of course, defines this trajectory, which is a function of I, which corresponds to fundamental frequencies, right? So in contrast, the FFV stuff that we've done before, we take two frames. We take the current frame the same as here, but we also take the previous frame. and we dilate the previous frame by logarithmic factors, by a range of them. And then again, we take the dot product of the dilated previous frame with the current frame. And then the locus of those dot products gives us another locus that is also a function of I, where I here is the logarithmic dilation factor. So this expresses the peak here nominally expresses the location of the peak, sorry, expresses the fundamental frequency in hertz, and the location of the peak here expresses the rate of change of fundamental frequency in octaves per second. Okay, so now I'm going to describe the experiments that we did to see whether this makes any sense at all. The data that we used was Wall Street Journal data, mostly coming from Wall Street, this corpus. The number of speakers that we had were 102 female speakers and 95 male speakers, and we did close-set classification for both genders separately. We used 10-second trials. We had enough. We gathered enough data to have 5 minutes of training, 3 minutes of development data, 3 minutes of test data, and that corresponded to approximately 1,400 to 1,800 trials that are 10 seconds apiece. all of the data comes from a single microphone type, and it's what we're calling matched multi-session, which means that for the majority of speakers, data that's both in the train, in the dev, and in the test set is drawn from all of the speakers, all of the sessions that are available for that speaker. Something that is not in the paper is, we did this afterwards, but I thought that you might appreciate this, is we built a system that's based just on pitch. And we extract pitch using a standard sound processing toolkit in its default settings. The comparison isn't quite fair because any pitch tracker currently actually uses dynamic programming. So this system is actually using long-term constraints, whereas our system will not, because it'll treat frames independently. We ignore unvoiced frames and we transform voiced frames to log2 domain. And what we see is that for females, this system achieves an accuracy of approximately 18% and approximately 27% for females and males, respectively. I get the feeling that my microphone is louder sometimes and quieter at other times. Is that true, or does it bother anyone? Okay, sorry. Okay, so the system that we're proposing here to explore this idea of modeling the entire transform domain signal, we don't perform any preemphasis, partly because we are not using frequencies below 300 hertz. So because we throw those away, there's no DC component. We decided not to bother with this. We have 75% frame overlap with 32 millisecond frames, and we use the Han window instead of the Hamming window, which is ubiquitously used. Number of dimensions and the number of Gaussians in our models still need to be optimized, and I'll describe that in coming slides. We don't use a universal background model, and we don't use any speech activity detection. So in optimizing this number of dimensions, what we have done here is we have created the most laconic model you can invent, a single Gaussian with a diagonal covariance, and we train our PCA and LDA transforms on the training set, and we select that number of dimensions which maximizes accuracy on the development set. Right? So we can see here that for the PCA transform, we achieve an accuracy of about 40% for the first top 10 discriminants, and an accuracy of about 85% for the first 10 LDA components for females, and slightly better for males, but that's approximately the ballpark. The lighter colors in these two plots represent longer trial durations. We decided not to do 60 seconds and 30 seconds, which is what we started out with, because the numbers were too high and it was difficult to make comparisons. So this table summarizes the performance of this HSCC system that I just described. Once the number of Gaussians has been set to optimize DevSet accuracy, and that number happens to be 256 in our experiments. What we see here is that if you take the representation that a pitch tracker is exposed to and you spend the time looking for the argmax in it, you'll achieve 18 and 27% respectively here. But if you don't bother doing that, you just throw everything that representation has and you model that, then you achieve almost 100%. So the claim here, based on these experiments, is that there is speaker discriminative information that is beyond the argmax in these representation vectors. And, of course, discarding it leads to performance that is not really comparable. Spending time improving argmax estimation appears unnecessary. And, of course, argmax estimation here is pitch estimation. Okay, so we also constructed a contrastive MFCC system, which is not really standard in the way that, that you probably build them, but we tried to retain as many similarities with the very simple HSC system as we could. So we did apply pre-emphasis and Hamming window because that just happens to be the standard front-end feature processing in our ASR systems. We retained 20 of the lowest order MFCCs, but then we also don't use a universal background model or any speech activity detection. So in this respect, the two systems are most comparable. And what we see when we compare these two systems is that essentially in every case, at least for this data and for these experiments that we did here, this HSCC representation outperforms the MFCC representation. But we're happy just saying that they're comparable in magnitude. We've also, just to be safe, applied LDA to the MFCC system. This is also not a fair thing to do because we actually haven't truncated or thrown away, discarded any dimensions after this. So we take 20 dimensions and we rotate them. It leads to negligible improvements here. If we combine the HSCC and the MFCC systems, then we achieve, we get improvements in every case, except for DevSet in males. Here, MFCCs don't seem to help. But other than that, in general, at least combination with MFCCs doesn't hurt. Okay, so given these results, I'm going to describe a couple of analyses or analysis of a couple of perturbations because we were interested in seeing how lucky we were in just guessing at the parameters that actually drive the configuration of our system. So we considered three different kinds of perturbations. One was changing the frequency range to which the filter bank is exposed. One is changing the number of comb filters in our filter bank, and the other is totally throwing out the so-called spectral envelope information, which is contained in MFCC features. And we had a very simple version of this analysis suite where we used only a diagonal covariance Gaussian, single diagonal covariance Gaussian per speaker. And we only show numbers on DevSet because we claim that they're sufficiently similar at a coarse granularity to the eval set numbers that we didn't actually bother doing those experiments. As before, I'm going to plot accuracy as a function of the number of dimensions. Okay, so the first perturbation has to do with modifying this low-order cutoff. As I said, the HSC system looks at frequencies between 300 hertz and 8 kilohertz, and it is interesting to see what happens if you choose a different value for this low-order cutoff, or low-frequency cutoff. So the results here for females on the left and males on the right indicate that what we had chosen, this 300 hertz cutoff, this just happens to correspond to the first 10, 50 bins in our space, was felicitous. That is to say, it led to the best performance. If we expose the algorithm to also frequencies between 0 and 300, then for females, we actually lose approximately 4% absolute here. The drop is much smaller for males. And moving the cutoff further up has a smaller effect, but it's also worse than keeping it at 300. The second perturbation that we observed, that we analyzed was changing the upper limit here. So, as I said, we had 300 to 8,000 to begin with, but it's interesting to see what happens if you cut it at 4,000 or 2,000. And this configuration in particular corresponds approximately to an upsampled 8 kilohertz telephone channel. So here again, results for males on the right and for females on the left. What we see is that for males, reducing the number of high-frequency components that you're looking at in the FFT has a more drastic effect than for females. For females, actually, going down to 4,000 is only a drop of less than 1% absolute. But then dropping it further, you see drops of approximately 3% absolute. I want to say that even under these sort of ridiculous ablation conditions, this significantly outperforms a pitch tracker, and of course it is not known how well a pitch tracker would operate on 300 to 2,000 hertz audio. So the third perturbation is that in the transform domain. So we, as I said at the very beginning, we have 400 filters and they're 1 hertz apart, and we're at liberty to choose however many filters we want there, right? So it's interesting to see what happens if you double that number and space them 0.5 hertz apart, or you have that number and space them twice as far apart. What the results show here for females on the left again and for males on the right is that increasing the resolution of the candidate fundamental frequencies with which you construct the filter bank actually leads to significant improvements for females of almost 2% absolute, and for males it's slightly smaller. But then decreasing resolution has a similar impact, a negative impact for both genders. Finally, the fact that the MFCC and HSCC features combine to improve performance in 3 out of 4 cases suggests that the two feature streams are complementary. But there's actually no proof of that until sort of now. So what we're going to do here is we're going to take the source domain FFT, and we're going to lifter it by transforming it into the real capstrom and then throwing out the low order capstral coefficients and then transforming it back into the spectrum domain. And I want to say here that the lower order real capstral coefficients correspond approximately to the low order MFCC coefficients, right? So ablating real capstral coefficients which are computed without a filter bank is very similar to removing exactly that information that's captured by MFCCs. So the system that we had, the HSC system that you saw the performance of in the table, we actually don't do any liftering, but we could lifter, you know, the first 13 low-order capture coefficients, which corresponds approximately to what people typically use in an ASR system, and or 20, which is what we used in our MFCC baseline that you saw earlier. And what ends up happening here, you can see that first I'll comment on females, is that removing the spectral envelope information actually improves performance here. So if we throw away the first 13 capstral coefficients, or sorry, the information contained in the first 13 capstral coefficients, we get an improvement of about 2% absolute, meaning that the spectral envelope information that's modeled in MFCCs actually hurts here for women. It's also the case that if we throw out 20 of them, we also do better than not throwing out any, but it's already not as good as only throwing out 13, which suggests that the capsule coefficients that are found between order 13 and 20 are useful. In males, doing any kind of ablation seems to, liftering seems to hurt, but the pain is smaller here. If you throw away the first 13, that's negligible. I believe that's one trial. And I have no idea whether it's statistically significant. So the findings of this is that this representation appears to be robust to perturbations of various sorts. There is play of approximately 5% absolute. The performance for female speakers seems to be more sensitive to these perturbations than for males in both pleasing and displeasing directions. And it's again important to say that even under these perturbed conditions, the performance of these systems is vastly superior to the performance that would be achieved if you spent a lot of time finding the argmax in the representation that pitch trackers are exposed to. We don't know how a pitch tracker would perform under these perturbations. So the summary of this talk, I still have 3 slides, sorry, is that the information that's available to a standard pitch tracker, because it's computed by this pitch tracker, and then subsequently discarded, is valuable for speaker recognition. And then the 3 points that I would like to pay specific attention to is that the performance achieved with HSCC features is comparable to that achieved with MFCC features. The information that's contained in these HSCCs appears complementary to the information contained in MFCCs, and the HSCC modeling appears to be at least as easy as MFCC modeling. So this evidence suggests, as I've probably said too often now, that improving estimation of detecting the argmax or finding the argmax in this representation, the goal of pitch trackers essentially, seems like an endeavor that doesn't warrant further time investment. And it's possible to simply model the entire transform domain and do better. If pitch is required for other high-level kinds of features, which of course we're ignoring here because we're not doing any long-distance feature computation, then at least that information should not be discarded, even if it's not used to estimate pitch. If these ideas generalize to other data types and other tasks, then there is some chance that this will lead to some form of paradigm shift in the way that prosody is modeled in speech. So I want to close with a couple of caveats. We don't actually know how these features compare to other instantaneous prosody vectors, right? So it's possible that if you had a vector that contains pitch and maybe harmonic to noise ratio and maybe some other things that are computable, you know, instantaneously for a single frame, then it would be much, the difference would be much smaller. We don't know that at the current time. We also don't know how this representation performs under various mismatch conditions. For example, channel or session or distance from microphone or vocal effort. So these are things that need to be explored. And it's also quite possible that that there are other classifiers that may be better suited to this. In particular, the performance that wasn't bad that we achieved with a single diagonal covariance Gaussian suggests that maybe SVMs would be much better. The feature vectors are large, right? So this presents some problems. Existing prosody systems, of course, focus a lot on long-term features, and we haven't attempted that here at all. So a simple thing to try would be to simply stack features from temporally adjacent frames or stack differences from features. But I think that probably the best thing to do is to simply compute the modulation spectrum over this so-called HST spectrogram. And of course, probably most importantly, we would really like to have a data-independent feature rotation, which allows us to compress the feature space. This would significantly improve understanding, because right now we just have this huge bag of numbers, and it would allow us to apply some normal things that people apply, like universal background models. And it would allow us to deploy it in other large data tasks. Thank you, Liz. Thank you.
Could you perhaps just help me understand your last point? Please explain to me why there is a difficulty in applying your method to a large. Is it because your feature vectors are very large, or?
Well, the first thing, so in the system that we describe most extensively here, the feature vector has 400 numbers, I have found it to be painful to.
So that's 400 every 10 millisecond frame.
Does that answer your question, or should I say something more? We've actually found that if you're looking at different kinds of mismatch, you need to do some homomorphic processing, which actually increases the size of this feature vector, and so it becomes even more painful. And it's basically because we don't really know how to really properly model this with a data-independent transform yet. So.
Okay, thanks. Because does seem like it would be very worthwhile to try this on a on a NIST data set. So
definitely,
it would be nice to think of ways to make that possible.
Definitely, and if any of you have any suggestions, I would be glad to take them. So.
Do you have any thoughts on how this might behave on mismatched data?
I think I do. We have some thoughts. So, but we don't have really the correct kinds of thoughts. So, no. So the problem is that the other data set that we've been playing with most recently after doing this is a far field data set. And so everything is far field. So there's a big change in what happens, and we actually don't really know exactly where the change is. So I guess we're now in the process of thinking about applying it to different data. But let me try to remember this table. This is on something called the Mixer 5 dataset, which contains lots of different channels, but the nine channels that we use are all the far field channels. And what we have there is we have two evaluation sets. One has session match, and the other is session mismatch. And then we build models for data from every channel and apply them to that same channel, and that's the match channel condition. And we also apply those models to data from every other channel, and that's the mismatch channel condition. So the mismatch channel condition consists of, I think it's 8 times 9. It's an average of 8 times 9 numbers, and the match channel condition is an average of 9 numbers. So what we see is that in session match and channel match conditions, we're doing something uninteresting there. But it appears here that session mismatch is more painful than channel mismatch, right? And there's a clear reversal here in the ordering between the MFCC system and the HSCC system that we reported in this work. This line, this HSCC old, is that system that I just described in this talk. HSCC new is something that we submitted to somewhere else, which is probably not going to be accepted, which is where this table comes from. The point is that these numbers in this row are always smaller than the MFCC. than the numbers in this row. So I don't know if that answers your questions. I can probably talk a little bit about the magnitudes of these numbers, but if you're happy with this, then yeah. I could say actually here that I don't recall, Jean, but I think that we did the combination here, and the combination leads to approximately a 10% absolute increase over this MFCC number on average over all the conditions, right?
Can I ask genome processing side?
Sorry?
Yeah, can I ask genome processing side? I think this proposed futures is similar to so-called aperiodicity measures or FFT strings used for MELP codings or mixed excitation codings.
I hate to interrupt you, but could you hold your microphone a little bit closer?
Sorry. Okay. I think you said this proposed future is similar to band-limited harmonic-to-noise ratios. Mm-hmm. And I think in addition to harmonic-to-noise ratios, this future would be similar to aperiodicity measures or FFT strengths, which is used for MELP codings, MELP codings, or mixed excitation systems. Mm. So do you have any comments on this point?
I have none. I'm not sure that I got all of the things that you said. But if you said that there is something that's very similar to this,
yeah.
I would actually really like to talk with you.
Yeah, let's talk.
And if you prefer, we can do that offline, or you can...
Yes, let's talk offline.
Thank you.
Just to come back to the 400-dimensional features, I think in one of your slides you mentioned LDA. Did you reduce that feature dimensionality before your modeling stage?
Sorry, can you ask that at the very beginning of your question? I missed.
Your features are 400-dimensional.
Yeah.
So did you use an LDA to reduce that dimensionality before your subsequent modeling stage?
Yeah.
So to what dimensionality did you reduce it?
Sorry, So it turns out that either for males or for females, it was 52 and 53. I don't remember which gender. It doesn't matter, right? It's close enough.
Okay, because then it would seem it's probably not a practical problem anymore. We typically use 60-dimensional features with a UBM that has 2,000 components, so that's doable.
Right, but the problem is that we would need to invert, we would need to compute the LDA or PCA transform over, because these transforms are global, right? So we would need to compute a PCA transform over 2,000 features for the entire, UBM training set, if you will. Right?
Did I understand you correctly? Did you say that the LDA transform is estimated in a data-dependent way, so it would be utterance by utterance at present?
No. What I meant, if I gave that impression, I didn't intend to.
So it's a universal dimensionality reduction.
Yes.
And in that case, I don't see why there would be a problem in using a universal background model to model these features. If you reduce everything down to 50 dimensions in the same way.
Right. So. I guess.
Why already training the extracting the features and then train this LDA for the target and kill our disk space, rack space. So basically, we start from like very simple and just exclude UBM training. And then because based on this data set, we do have the UBM set and the train set, dev set, and test set involved. But realistic empirical reason, we couldn't do it due to some limitation.
Okay, but it's not a difficulty in principle.
I think it's just
problem.
A time.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, we just haven't gotten around yet to getting that far. And like I said, with feature vectors of the order of 400 or 800, as we've shown being better, and 2048 after some homomorphic fiascos, we just haven't gotten around to even estimating how much disk space we would need on a particular corpus. So that's essentially the correct answer there. But my thought always was that we were going to attack this problem by making the feature vectors smaller first, rather than addressing the infrastructure problem and buying more disks, right? So.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's thank Cornell and Chin, and that concludes the session.